these drop boxes that are not part of the county's official election collection process are illegal. If you participate in those activities, you are knowingly engaging in an activity that is against the law. These drop boxes, which are part or set up by a local political party or the state party, are not official drop boxes.
California Attorney General Javier Becerra yesterday, after sending a cease and desist letter to the California Republican Party to stop operating unofficial ballot drop boxes. Dozens of them have popped up across the state, including here in L.A. and Orange counties. To the untrained eye, they don't look all that different from the official ballot drop boxes the state is using to make voting easier during the pandemic. The state Republican Party has defended its practice, saying California allows for ballot harvesting. Spokesman Hector Barajas spoke to KQED's California Report.
We will respond to the cease and desist letter, but we will continue our ballot harvesting program. If the Secretary of State would like to provide us what section code or what election code has been violated, we would love to see it. And we will continue to do our ballot harvesting. And if they've got a problem with it, we'll see them in court.
So, who's right? Let us ask election law guru Rick Hassan, law professor and political scientist at UC Irvine. His latest book is Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. Welcome back.
Great to be with you again.
All right. So your book has the words dirty tricks in it. Is this a dirty trick or is it legal?
Well, it might be neither. there are a lot of gray areas here. It's very curious that this is going on. And some people were speculating that this was an attempt by the Republican Party of California to facilitate voter fraud. I don't think that's what's going on. I think it's one of two things. Number one, the president has made all kinds of incendiary comments about vote by mail, claiming without evidence that they're rigged. And this is discouraging turnout among Republicans voting by mail. And usually in California and in Arizona and in Florida, Republicans work very hard to use vote by mail as a way to get out the vote. And so this may be a way to encourage Republicans to vote by mail in a way that they might be more comfortable with, rather than giving their ballot to election officials or in the U.S. mail, they're giving it to the Republican Party. The other thing that might be going on is that this is really more about trying to show the hypocrisy of Democrats who are allowing ballot harvesting. Why is it that the union member can go door to door and collect these ballots, but us setting up a drop box is somehow wrong, to try and highlight what they consider to be an effort that facilitates fraud? But that's kind of weird, because then if that's what they believe, they're facilitating more fraud. It really is a strange situation.
It does sound like a strange situation. And because a lot of these ballot boxes, these drop boxes, were at places where more Republicans would be likely to gather, such as at gun shops and at Republican Party headquarters, you could assume that what you said about encouraging a Republican turnout would be the likely explanation. So if that is true, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with having boxes where people can drop off their ballots and then whoever opens these boxes can then mail them off to the Secretary of State?
Right. So I think there are two different issues. Number one, there's the question of the ballots saying that they are official drop boxes. That sounds like it's fraudulent because they're not government drop boxes. And so, as I understand it, the Republican Party is going to remove the word official from these boxes. And that's a good thing, because we want people to understand what they're doing if they're giving their ballot to a third party. The other question, which I think is a harder question, is whether it is in fact illegal to set up these boxes. So California's law says that if you want to collect a ballot from another person, you're allowed to do that. And by law, you have to turn it in. You can't keep that ballot. It also says that if you're giving your ballot to a third person, that third person is supposed to sign the ballot on the outside of the ballot. But the law is that the ballot's going to be counted whether or not that's signed. The statute says that you can hand the ballot to another person. So it's putting it in a box, not giving it to a person. It's not giving it to a person directly. That's why I think this matter may end up in court over the fight over the legality of these rules. But I think the real issue, besides the legality, is the fact that if these are boxes that are not under the control of the state, they could potentially be tampered with. They may not have the same security controls in place as the government drop boxes. The one that's near the public library near where I voted is a very solid box. It's tamper-proof, it's fireproof. It's in a well-lighted place where people can see if someone tries to tamper with it. The concern is if these boxes are not well secured, that somebody could tamper with the ballots and those ballots might never arrive in the hands of election officials.
So then that could boomerang for the state Republicans, because if they're putting these boxes in places where more Republicans would likely use them, and then perhaps these ballots could be, I don't know, lost in the mail or tampered with, or just, I don't know, just not arrive where they're supposed to go, then that would be a loss of Republican votes.
Sure. It wouldn't be the first time that Republicans were acting counterproductively. I think discouraging vote by mail in the middle of a pandemic itself is quite an unproductive thing to do, given that we want to give people safe and healthy ways to be able to cast their ballots. I think the Republicans could turn around and say it's no less safe than handing your ballot to a stranger who comes to your door, which is totally allowed under California law. I mean, that's why I've come out and said that California should switch to the system that they have in Colorado, which lets a person collect up to only 15 ballots. I think that's a reasonable way to help people who need help getting their ballot to a mailbox or a drop box, but not allowing, you know, ballots to be floating out there in any case.
These ballots that have already been dropped off in these boxes, will they still be valid?
So if the ballots arrive sealed and they are delivered to election officials, they would still be counted. We're not going to penalize voters, even if the way that the ballot is collected by the ballot collector, in this case, the party setting up the drop boxes, violates the state law. So it's not going to hurt voters so long as the ballots are actually turned in. As I said, my biggest worry is that someone's going to mess with these ballot boxes, which may not be as secure as the government ballot boxes, and potentially destroy ballots.
So what's the next move here? Because the Secretary of State says legal action could be on the horizon if the California Republican Party doesn't take these boxes down.
Well, either the government officials could try to sue the Republican Party to get them to remove the boxes, or the government might seize the boxes, which could cause the Republican Party to sue the government, or the Republican Party might just try to sue the government now to get clarification of what the rules are. But one way or the other, I expect this issue is quickly going to end up in court.
Quickly, because the election is in 3 weeks.
Well, that's right. And every day people are voting. You know, we don't have a voting day now. We have a voting month, and thousands of ballots are being turned in every hour right now. So, yeah, so the time really is of the essence.
Rick Hassin, political scientist and law professor at UC Irvine. His latest book is called Election Meltdown: Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. Rick, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the whole ballot box controversy isn't the only voting issue making people anxious. Mail-in balloting is raising a lot of questions, such as, how do I know I signed the envelope in the right place? Will my signature be recognized? Should I just vote in person? Is that more secure? Here to answer some voting how-to questions is Kim Alexander, president of the nonpartisan nonprofit group California Voter Foundation. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, let's begin with registering to vote, because the deadline to do that is this coming Monday. So how do you do that?
You can do that online very easily at the Secretary of State's website, registertovote.ca.gov. And if you have a driver's license, you can do it using that number, and your signature on your license becomes your voter registration signature. So that's super convenient, because then when you're signing your ballot envelope, you can make it match the signature on your license.
What happens if you miss the Monday deadline?
Well, we have a lot of fail-safes in California's election process. We still have something called conditional voter registration. If you miss the deadline on October 19th, you can still conditionally register and vote in the days after that, all the way up to and on election day. You would fill out a registration application at your voting site and also fill out your ballot. It will go in that envelope and they will check your registration and make sure you didn't vote somewhere else. And if you didn't, they will process your application and count your ballot.
Okay. So if you are registered, though, you probably have received your ballot, because every Californian was mailed a ballot. But what if you didn't get it? What if it was lost in the mail, or your dog ate it, or whatever?
You shouldn't panic, but you should have received your ballot by about now. They were all required to go out by October 5th. Some counties mailed them even earlier than that. So if you didn't get your ballot, you should contact your county elections office, find out where it went, and have them update your registration. You may need to fill out a new voter registration application if you moved. If it went to an old address, they can cancel that, void out that ballot, and issue you a new one, but you do have to update your registration to do that.
So I've received my ballot. I'm filling it out. Uh-oh, I made a mistake. What next? Do I have to throw it out and get a new one, or can I fix it?
Well, it kind of depends on the size of the mistake. I mean, if you really made your ballot unreadable or spilled coffee on it or something like that, you probably want to get a new ballot. You can do that by calling your county elections office and asking them to void out the ballot that they issued for you and send you a new one. You can also go to a voting site, and in many counties, those will start opening up on October 24th and get a new ballot there. But if you just made a little mistake, like maybe you filled in the wrong oval, you can cross it out and fill in the correct oval. If you write on your ballot, draw pictures on it, which some people do, you can still have that ballot counted. Or if you write your name or initials on it, they will have to remake that ballot though. And counties do this in teams of two. I mean, when they open up these envelopes, they find all kinds of things. So, you know, if there is a ballot that gets torn on the way coming in, or if something was spilled on it, they will remake those ballots so they can be properly scanned and counted.
Okay. So then all that is done. I have to sign it. How do I make sure I sign it correctly in the right place with the right signature?
So you don't sign the ballot. You sign the envelope. That's super important.
Okay, and so I just made a mistake.
Well, you know what, Madeline, you're in good company. I mean, people always say, don't forget to sign your ballot. And we have to make sure people realize you're signing the envelope, not the ballot itself. Every ballot envelope in the state looks a little bit different based on what county you live in, but they all have similar elements. They all will have an area on the envelope for you to sign and date it. You want to date it the day that you're signing it. You want to sign it the way you signed your voter registration. So that means if you registered online, you can look at your driver's license and make your ballot envelope signature look like that. You can update your registration and provide a new signature. You can also go online and see if your other recent ballots were counted, if you're wondering if your signature is going to match sufficiently. If there is a problem with your signature, and this is, it doesn't happen a lot, but it is one of the leading reasons why ballots do get rejected. Before your ballot would be rejected, your county has to contact you and provide you with a chance to submit a new signature. So this is a good reason to sign up for ballot tracking, because you will get notified immediately if there is a problem with your ballot or your signature.
And how do you sign up for ballot tracking?
You go online to the Secretary of State's website, wheresmyballot.sos.ca.gov. There are a lot of great lookup tools for voters online. You can check if your past ballots were counted. You can check with your county, their information for you. They may have lookup tools also for your voting locations, your drop boxes. You can find all these online on our site. We actually have at calvoter.org, a jump page that's all voter tools. So you can go to our site and find the voter tools page and get to all these great resources.
Okay, and when should I send it off? We've been hearing for a while now about all the postal service problems.
We want people to return their ballots as early as they can. You can return your ballot to any official ballot drop box in your county, or actually any county in the state. You can return your voted ballot to a voting site. If you don't want to vote that vote by mail ballot and you want to vote in person, you have that option too. The best thing to do is to take the ballot you were issued with you to your voting site and turn it in. If you are going to mail it, and many people will, you should plan to return it a week before the election. That's October 27th, and get it in the mail by then. We do have a law in California that requires ballots postmarked by election day to be counted, and we have a 17-day grace period for this election. But the best day to mail your ballot is a week before the election. If you miss that, the last day I would recommend putting a ballot in a mailbox is the Saturday before the election. There, you know, it should be picked up by that Monday or Tuesday. But even putting it in a mailbox on Monday, or putting it out in your own mailbox on Monday, I'm not sure we'll guarantee that it will get postmarked by election day. So I wouldn't cut it close. If you really want to make sure your ballot's going to be counted, drop it off in person if you're really going to be voting that close to election day.
And of course, if you want to vote in person, you can go to a voting center in LA County. They open October 24th, and you can find locations at lavote.net. Kim Alexander is president of the nonpartisan California Voter Foundation. Kim, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Just the other day, it arrived in the mail. Got my California ballot, said, ain't that swell. Gonna open it, make sure it all checks out. Gonna do a little homework before I start to fill it out.
Okay, that is Kim Alexander singing with the musicians of the California Voter Foundation, singing her tips for how to vote. All right, speaking of raising your voice, letting it be heard, we want to hear from you right now at kcrw.com/join. Become a member. We are in our fall membership drive. Renew your membership, up your existing membership, whatever it takes. We really need your support. This is, of course, an unprecedented time. You hear that every single day. You live it every single day. But for us here at KCRW, it certainly is. We are struggling to survive with a lot of media organizations and a lot of local organizations, and we are surviving thanks to you, but we can't continue to do it without our listeners, without our supporters. So, wow, put the power of your local vote in favor of your local radio station here at KCRW. Any amount gets you membership. We just need you to come in and join. KCRW.com/join, 800-600-5279. And thank you so, so much for making the decision to be part of your local radio community. Coming up, speaking of local, we're going to talk about the city council race in LA that's drawing big endorsements from people like Bernie Sanders and Hollywood celebrities. That story is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Let's talk now about a race for LA City Council that's drawing big money and celebrity endorsements. In the Koreatown, Silver Lake, Hollywood area, incumbent David Rue is facing a challenge from Nithya Raman. She's an urban planner and community activist and a first-time candidate, and she forced Rue into a runoff. Now she's been endorsed by Bernie Sanders and Natalie Portman. Big names for a local race, a race in which both candidates are trying to be the more progressive choice. John Regardi has been following this race for LA Magazine, and he joins me now. Hi, John.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, let's talk about the runoff back in March. So Nithya Raman got 41% of the vote to Rue's 45%. And that's despite being a first-time candidate, not having the name recognition, and despite the fact that she was vastly outspent by Rue. So how did that happen?
Well, I think one thing we have to understand is we have to look at not only are these candidates interesting, but this race is really interesting. 2020 is the first time, Madeline, that the city moved its local elections from odd-numbered years to even-numbered years. The effort was to align them with state and federal ballots and thus to increase turnout. And it really worked. Back in 2015, when David Rue was first elected in that primary, 24,000 people voted. This time, 76,000 people voted. So you had more than 50,000 additional people who were invested in the democratic process, which changed everything. Campaigns had to deal with a vast new base. There were a lot more people to communicate to, reach out to. So really, you have a situation where new ground was being charted, and the candidates on the fly and their campaigns were having to figure out how to do it.
Right. And so how did she do it? How did she break through all the noise and enter into this final race?
Well, I think there were two parts of as to how she was able to do it. And the first part is you actually have to look at maybe what David Rue didn't do. You know, David Rue, you know, he got this 45%. If you don't get more than 50%, you move on to a runoff. And he's acknowledged that he did not run the campaign that he wished he had run. You know, he has changed a lot of his campaign management team since then. And, you know, when he and I spoke, he told me, quote, "I did not do enough to let voters know who I am, what my story was, and reintroduce myself." He said what he should have done is really run more of a grassroots campaign equivalent to what he did in 2015. Now, interestingly, that is precisely what Nithya Raman did. She really ran this aggressively grassroots, you know, campaign, got, you know, help and involvement from neighborhood groups such as, you know, Ground Game LA and Food and Water Network. When we spoke, she told me that she had more than 600 volunteers, you know, on her campaign. She says she has even more now, and that they knocked on 83,000 doors leading up to the March primary. You know, what she told me was that they, you know, her team recognized that the people were going to be out there. And, you know, her comment was, you know, all we have to do is convince them that this race matters and they deserve better than what they've been getting. So that was part of it. Other parts were, as you said, tying in with local fundraisers, getting, you know, some Hollywood, you know, bright lights to chime in. She had on her website, you know, testimonials from Natalie Portman and Jane Fonda. So she really did mobilize, you know, a base of people.
Right. And so talk a little bit about how she was able to do that. And is it her issues, are they that markedly different from Rue, her positions on issues? Because it seems like just a cursory look at they seem to be more alike than different.
And that's a great point, because I really think, you know, that, you know, that's the case. You know, the Los Angeles City Council is already a pretty liberal body. David Rue is one of the more liberal members of that, and he views himself as a progressive. Nithya Raman has really sought to cast herself as even more progressive than David Rue, which has created this unique situation where David says, you know, no, I'm the more progressive. You know, and, you know, in a way, you know, some people have even referred to this race as a case of left versus lefter. So, you know, they certainly do, you know, and as you said, they probably do have a lot more similarities than differences, you know, in terms of policies. Now, are there some differences? Yes, of course. You know, certain things like on City Hall corruption, which is a key issue. David Rue has been saying, hey, we should address that by getting a new inspector general to pay more attention to relationships between the real estate development industry and politicians. Nithya has countered, you know, instead of doing something brand new like that, let's just invest funds and resources into the City Ethics Commission, the City Controller's Office. But again, in a lot of these issues, as you correctly surmised, they do align. You know, both are very impassioned about addressing homelessness, doing it humanely and responsibly. Both have been very fierce about talking about the vital need to protect renters as this coronavirus pandemic wears on. They both say, again, going back to City Hall corruption, that one way to resolve this would be give the council less power. Both want the City Council to be expanded beyond its 15 members. You know, I've spoken to both people. I've watched them. Both of them really seem to care. They seem more drawn by public service than by ego. So, yeah, you know, there are those differences. And again, there's also some of the backing that you've pointed out. You know, Bernie Sanders has endorsed Nithya Raman. Today, David Rue announced that, you know, Nancy Pelosi is behind him. But overall, you know, if this were not the 4th District of Los Angeles, we'd probably look at them and go, yeah, there's a lot of overlap between these two.
So how is a voter supposed to determine the difference? What are some of the key areas where they do differ?
Well, you know, and one of the great things is, you know, about this is that actually both candidates have really gone and have provided a lot of information for voters to make that decision themselves. Nithya Raman, her, you know, her platform is deep and robust, certainly far more impressive than I've seen written about, or that, you know, that I've seen most first-time candidates ever do. Same thing with, you know, David Rue. He's got a lot of information, you know, about him, and he's, you know, he tries to point to the things that he's, you know, already done in office. So, you know, there are a lot of opportunities for voters, you know, to, you know, find out that information themselves.
Right. And so as we talked about, this is a vast area, vast district, and it covers the area of Hollywood and Silver Lake, Los Feliz, Koreatown, but also stretches into the valley into Sherman Oaks. And so is it difficult for these candidates to address all political corners of this district. Sure, it's probably mainly a liberal district, but there are conservative pockets, or more conservative pockets.
Absolutely, and that's a very key point. I mean, as you just mentioned, this is 41 square miles in the last redistricting process back in 2011. It was put together like this weird sort of, you know, stitched together like this odd, like Frankenstein's monster. So yes, we certainly do, you know, you certainly do have, you know, more conservative areas with maybe more homeowners, you know, in the Sherman Oaks part of it. And one thing that's also really interesting is, you know, going back to what we talked about before, that vast expansion of voters, you know, there's a belief that, you know, we are seeing, you know, in the past where maybe Los Angeles City Council elections saw a lot of, you know, particularly white homeowners who voted, that now we're seeing people from a lot more across an ethnic spectrum. We are seeing a lot more renters involved in this, you know, per what you said, you know, some people said, hey, maybe what David Ruse should be doing at this point is trying to lock down that conservative base and not try to go even more left. But again, with so many people, it's hard to reach out to everyone. And it's expensive, too. Again, 76,000 voters in the last election, potentially more now.
How much money, real quick, has been spent on this election?
In the first round, David Ruse spent nearly $1.2 million. Nithya Raman spent $423,000. But, you know, as of a few days ago, Nithya Raman had a cash advantage, $451,000 to $327,000 for David Ruse. But we're also going to see David Ruse benefit from independent expenditures from labor groups, et cetera.
John Rigardi, covering the District 4 race for LA Magazine. Thanks, John.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, local bookstores like Pasadena's venerable Vroman's are barely hanging on.
And sooner or later, you follow the numbers. If you don't have enough in your checking account, you're in trouble.
Will local bookstores survive? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The oldest and largest independent bookstore in Southern California has seen it all. Vroman's in Pasadena was founded in 1894. Since then, it's endured the 1918 pandemic, two world wars, a depression, a recession, and everything else. Now, the store may have met its match with the coronavirus. Vroman's is in danger of going out of business. And this bookstore is not alone. Some of its competitors here in L.A. have reported anywhere from a 50 to 80% drop in sales. Last month, the majority owner and chairman of the bookstore, Joel Sheldon, asked customers to buy gift cards and start their holiday shopping early to help keep the store afloat. And Joel Sheldon joins me now. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. And it's also a pleasure to go to your bookstore, although I confess I haven't actually been inside for a while now, which I suppose is part of the problem. How dire is your financial situation?
Well, especially with the response to our outreach campaign, it's very clear that we'll get into the new year. How far into the new year, no one knows. It first is dependent on whether the virus raises its ugly head again. And if we were to have to shut down for another month or two or longer, that would be very, very precarious.
By raising its ugly head again, the head has not gone away. And are you saying if the virus doesn't recede, that if there isn't a vaccine soon or what have you, then that's it for the business?
Well, at some point, obviously, and we will not be the only business. You simply cannot have no income and still have to pay a mortgage or maintenance of your inventory or any of the normal expenses of running a business. You just can't do it with no income.
Yeah, seems obvious. No income and you can't survive for long. Do you have absolutely no income? You're not generating any sales on the website or anything like that?
Oh, no. We've generated sales. We reopened in June. We were shut for 6 to 8 weeks with no income, but our sales did not rebound to a normal level. And so, you're getting the first month 30% of your normal income. Well, that, by the way, the profit margin in a successful bookstore is 2% of sales. So most of all the sales are eaten up by expenses. So if you're not at your break-even point, you're still going to lose money. We always felt we could get to Christmas and get through Christmas, which is another crucial moment in time. But without the increased sales, it was going to be, again, precarious.
Well, given the fact that it probably won't be until well after Christmas that people feel comfortable going into stores again, and the fact that when winter comes, most people are expecting a spike in infections, what are you planning for in the months after Christmas?
Oh, boy. There isn't much planning for this because we simply don't know what that environment will be. And I do not feel alone in this. This is happening throughout our economy, specifically with retailing. But also, if you look at commercial buildings, they're not filling up and the rents aren't all full in what used to be downtown office buildings. And of course, those people used to spill out onto the streets and buy things in downtowns and places like Pasadena. In a sense, I simply can't answer that question. I don't have any idea. We will continue to track everything that we're doing, continue to plan. We'll continue to do those things. And sooner or later, you follow the numbers. If you don't have enough in your checking account, you're in trouble.
Have you had to lay staff off and take other cost-cutting measures?
Sure, yes. We got a PPP loan that was exceptionally useful, and we think we've complied with all the rules, and hopefully that will be forgiven along with the guidelines of those rules. We basically furloughed a lot of people. Any number went on unemployment, and some have, gone back to school and all kinds of things.
Hmm. Meanwhile, your online competitor, if you will, Amazon, seems to be doing very, very well. And Amazon was already an existential threat to bookstores such as yours. But the fact that Amazon is doing so well, is that also another issue, another problem for you?
Of course it is. All that the shutting down of the economy because of the coronavirus has essentially driven people to those big companies. So those big companies that had robust websites and were trying to compete and battle it out in the online market, those companies have certainly done well, while the rest of us have been shut down with no customers.
Yeah. So if Romans survived the last pandemic, the Spanish flu, does that give you any hope that it'll survive this pandemic?
It's not really comparable because, to my knowledge, Romans wasn't shut down. There's no record of that in our history. And my family has been involved since 1914. And I've gone through all the corporate record books over my period of 50 years involvement. And I don't recall anything about the Spanish flu in 1918 in Pasadena in those records.
Hmm. So this is definitely the biggest challenge your bookstore has ever faced.
Yes, I think that's fair to say. Yes.
Well, I wish you all the luck in the world, and I hope that you pull through this.
Well, thank you. Well, we're gonna do everything we can. We're gonna work very hard. We will face the challenge. We've got great people. They're doing everything they can. We have a better chance than most in the bookstore side of the business, but it is a significant challenge.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Okay, thank you.
Joel Sheldon, chairman of LA's oldest independent bookstore, Romans. Okay, so you're going to try to shop local and you're going to try to support local institutions like Romans, like KCRW, kcrw.com/join. We are in our fall fundraiser, and just like the bookstores, just like the local restaurants, just like all the stuff that makes LA, LA, we too need you. We need your support. We need your help. We need your financial help this season more than ever because, as you just heard, it is a tough one for us out there. So if you can, and we know that you're suffering too, a lot of you, but if you can and you have extra money, please, won't you consider donating to KCRW, becoming a new member, kcrw.com/join. Tons of great thank you gifts there. Lots of great swag, including, of course, because tis the season, tis this era, we have KCRW masks. So, yeah, you can get a set of masks with KCRW emblazoned on them because why not? KCRW.com/join. Come on in and join the party. KCRW.com/join. 800-600-5279. And thank you so much for doing so. And joining me now is Steve Chiotakis, host of Greater LA. What's on your show today, Steve?
In just a few minutes, Madeline, we're going to talk about Prop 22. You know, in addition to the pandemic going on and everything else, there's an election happening in just a couple or 3 weeks. And on that ballot is Prop 22, which I guess if you look at it, is whether rideshare drivers want independence or whether they want full employment. And we're going to talk about both sides of the issue and even some other perspectives, too, coming up on the show.
All right. I've heard that is a very, very expensive race that... companies.
The most expensive ballot measure in the history of the United States. How about that?
Oh, my goodness.
We're talking tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars spent on this campaign. A lot.
Incredible. Okay, so there's obviously a lot at stake. Tune in to find out exactly what coming up at 1 o'clock. Thank you, Steve.
You bet.
Coming up, how Hollywood agents and casting directors are adjusting to our new reality. That's coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Time now for TV on the Radio.
Clear eyes, full hearts, get loose.
Oh my God, they've killed Kenny!
Three words for you. Treat, yo, so.
I am the one who knocks.
That's what she said.
Well, the TV and movie business has been virtually shut down since the pandemic hit in mid-March, so about 7 months now. The industry is trying to adjust. Disney announced yesterday it's restructuring and will focus on streaming now. People are still hesitant to go out to the movies. And the theater chain Regal says it's closing more than 500 theaters nationwide. Production is also way down, and that means fewer roles for actors. Here to talk about the new landscape, we have an agent and a casting director joining us. Stuart K. Robinson is CEO of the talent agency Brady, Brandon, and Rich. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Also joining us is casting director Risa Brayman Garcia. She has cast a bunch of blockbuster films and popular television shows. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Well, happy to be here, too.
Well, it's great to have you. And let's begin with you, Risa. The fall television season just began. So normally, you'd be pretty busy this time of year?
Yeah, normally, but this is not normally. No. So there are other places that have opened up sooner. So there's a lot going on in Vancouver. There's a lot going on in Atlanta, which has become sort of a hub of COVID sets where protocols are being implemented. There's a lot happening overseas, ton of stuff in New Zealand and Australia, and things are starting to pick up in LA. And where the sets can be contained, where shows are already established and they can write to contained sets, things are happening in LA as well. But it's slow and it's not nearly what it was.
Stuart, can you confirm that? It's pretty slow right now.
Yeah, we're fortunate at Brady, Brandon, and Rich because the bigger part of our business is commercials. And obviously, it's easier for the industry to figure out ways to get creative in 30 seconds than it is for an hour-long television show or a feature film. And when you talk about agents, you have to break it down into categories. I would suppose commercial agents are probably doing the best, but I'd say we're at 30% of where we normally would be business-wise this time of year. But wow. A film and TV agent is going to have a tougher time. And if you're a live theater agent, you're really having a rough year.
Yeah. I've heard that there's a lot more happening in the commercial world. And I know actors are going out for commercials almost exclusively.
Yeah, you know, they started out with shooting in the actor's home. They would send the equipment and actually have the actor set up the camera and shoot it themselves. And now they're starting to open up sets with one or two actors and distance them appropriately.
So, Risa, how does that change your job, if it does? Are you starting to cast commercials?
No, I did that a long, long time ago. Not my thing. But I have I'm fortunate in a couple of ways. One is that I have a show that was about to start shooting on the 16th of March that is still alive, and we're still doing a little bit of work, and we're getting ready to go back and shoot probably a year later than planned. So all of last year's pilots, you know, are starting to think about shooting in the spring, which is kind of crazy that we lost an entire year. But there's a ton of stuff that's in the planning phase, waiting for the moment when the doors open. And then there are things like there's a ton of stuff happening in Vancouver, where in Canada, they have figured out how to control their universe, not just on sets, but in their lives. So it's been manageable there.
And are productions looking for different kinds of talent now? Is there a different process? Are they looking for different faces than they were pre-COVID?
I'm not experiencing that really. The only thing that I know, which is kind of fabulous, is that it's opened up a way for actors to put themselves on tape or to do a virtual audition from anywhere in the world. If you're an actor in a regional market, you have the same access to the industry now and to auditions than anybody who was in Los Angeles or New York. So in that way, it's opened things up to know and learn and see more people and newer faces.
So the difference for us is not such a difference in what casting companies and ad agencies are looking for, but it's a little harder for us to answer the need because we have to check which clients would travel or would go to a set or would do a self-tape. And we do it with a color system, gold, silver, bronze, pewter, metal, et cetera. In other words, there are different categories of how willing they are to leave the house and expose themselves to whatever. In all of those cases, we make sure that the sets are practicing the proper distancing protocols, et cetera. But no, it doesn't change who we represent. It just changes who's available for what project.
Well, how risky is it to send an actor out there these days? I mean, how do you know if the set is safe?
You don't really. I mean, what I've heard from a lot of actors who have been out there working, and they've been doing everything from their series regulars to guest stars to people going to commercial sets, there's a real range. And the way to know that is to know that studio or network or production company or financier or ad agency is adhering to all of the union protocols. And sometimes they are and sometimes they aren't. Sometimes it's incredibly strict and it requires a really strong amount of flexibility and patience. You know, you're tested every day or every other day. It's a very different way of working. And then I've heard from people who have done some work that you'd think would be at a certain level, where they're saying like people aren't social distancing and they aren't wearing masks, and you come out of makeup and hair and you can't put a mask on. But then other people aren't wearing masks and people are surprised by that. And it's really important that actors know and crew members know that they have to advocate for themselves and not be afraid, because there has to be safety, you know?
Yeah, and the talent agency, we're asking all of those questions and we're making sure that our clients know what they're getting themselves into or what they want to pass on, but we ask all of those questions.
So what about in the audition part of it? You say that people are self-taping. Is there a moment where they do actually have to come in and audition in front of people?
I don't know what's happening in the commercial world. I know, and you can speak to that, Stuart, that there people have been auditioning at home. They've been auditioning with their entire family, you know, as a package. It's kind of been kind of really lo-fi and interesting and really fun. But all of the auditions that I know of that are happening either as a virtual audition, so you're doing it via Zoom, via other platforms, and it's a new way of working, and we're all learning how to do that. For me, it's really easy because I run an acting studio, the BGB studio, and we are on Zoom all the time. We've got 30 classes every week on Zoom, and so we have become, you know, pretty sophisticated at how to do this and how we're seeing really deep, intimate connections among actors, which I'm bringing then into the audition platform.
And in the commercial world, it started out with all self-tapes. And we, as agents, we in some cases had to produce some tutorials, how to self-tape, how to light yourself, how to send the files, how to do all of that. And our clients did a great job of picking up on that. Then there was a brief period where they kind of tried to open up the live auditions for a while. but it didn't last very long. And now we're finding self-tape first call and callbacks. If your listeners know what that is, callbacks tend to happen on Zoom so they can see you in person and interact with you. And then sets to shoot at home is more and more sets these days, less and less shooting at home.
What do you mean? What does that mean? Going to set rather than shooting yourself at home?
Yes. We've had a number of cases where they send the equipment to the actor's home and say, set it up like this. And then on a Zoom, they tell you when to push record, et cetera. And they shoot the whole spot at home. But more and more now, they're creating sets where the actor travels to the set and shoots.
Risa, you said something that sounded unusual, and that is that you're auditioning whole families. Like, you have the actor and then their family is getting involved.
Well, I haven't been doing much of this, but I know that for a lot of commercials and some television stuff, if you need a mother and child, or if you need a brother, sister, or if you need a couple, people have been auditioning sometimes as an entire family, mostly for commercials and then sometimes for guest spots. And they've been putting themselves on tape as a family or as a couple. But I think that now that people are actually getting out into the world more for the ultimate work, like for shooting, that's not happening as much. But it was very sweet where you know, a couple could audition as a couple and would get cast as a couple. And then they would either shoot at home or come to set as a couple, because then they didn't have to be at risk of infecting another actor or being infected. But again, as the protocols are being honored and practiced, and every set has a COVID protocol expert on set advising the producers and the studio and the networks and the ad agencies, et cetera, how to do this so that everybody's working in the same way and so that it is really safe.
Yeah.
I think the casting process is going to stay like this for quite some time, because also we're learning a new way of working, and producers and studio executives and directors are actually enjoying the fact that they can work with actors virtually. So the director could be in Morocco, the producer could be in LA, the actor could be in New York, and they could all work together to direct actors in auditions even more easily than they could before COVID, which is kind of exciting.
Stuart, what do you think? What do you think will be permanent changes in the industry?
I agree with Risa. I think that now that we're getting a handle on the technology, I think that there's going to be a lot more use of Zoom and self-tapes and things like that. I also think the actors are getting better at lighting themselves and getting the right equipment and dedicating a space in their home where they can audition. I know we've had a number of spots where, of course, they wanted a couple being intimate, so it's easier just to cast a great actress and that actress's significant other so that they don't have to worry about keeping them separate and distancing them, et cetera. But I think now that actors are getting more comfortable taping themselves, and now that the other side has found a way to direct them via Zoom, I think it's a best of both worlds. And I agree with Risa that it cuts out a lot of the travel, and it certainly cuts out the catering and serving lunches and all of that to the people who come.
Yeah. But that also means a lot of people don't have jobs. And in your part of the business, at agencies, there have been some waves of a lot of layoffs, right? Endeavor laid off 250 people, Paradigm 100, UTA announced salary reductions. So there's been a lot of pain that goes along with this.
It's a very painful time.
Yeah.
And again, you got to go by categories. In other words, if I were a company that represented Broadway actors specifically, what is there to do? What business is there until, I think they're saying, you know, May or June of next year is the earliest possible that they'll be looking at productions again. So a company like that is really having a hard time. So an Endeavor, WME, they have so many departments that are dependent upon people being able to be close and access one another. It's hard on those departments. But as Risa says, they're slowly finding ways around that, so we hope they do it in time for all these people to get their jobs back. My company, at 30% of the business, we're at half staff now. We've had to furlough a number of people, and we're counting the days till we can get everybody back. But at the end of the day, we're in an industry where we're constantly forced to be resourceful, and we're constantly forced to be resilient. We're constantly forced to find new ways to find solutions to creative problems, and that's what we're going to do.
Stuart K. Robinson is CEO of the Brady, Brannon and Rich Talent Agency, and Risa Brayman Garcia is a casting director. She runs the BGB studio. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, we just have a few more seconds left of the show to get you to go online at kcrw.com/join and join our growing family here at KCRW. We cannot do this show. We cannot run this radio station with our unique mix of music, news, and culture without you. And we have a $25,000 challenge grant that expires at midnight tonight. So support by midnight and your gift will be matched dollar for dollar by one of our board members, Sharam and Sarah Deljani. They will contribute $25,000 if we raise $25,000. So your dollar goes twice as far. So a great reason to do it now at kcrw.com/join. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.